Thanasi, start your recording.
Recording.
And Devi, start your recording.
Recording.
And Jamie.
Recording.
Okay, let's try this again. You're listening to the Useful Science Podcast. This is episode 8, recorded on December 20th, 2015. This week, we're going to learn about the effect of old misconceptions on learning new concepts, painful math anxiety, and healthy personalities. Useful Science is a website where we post one-sentence summaries of scientific research relevant to your everyday life. On this podcast, we're going to bring on a rotating panel of our science contributors to pick out a few items from the Useful Science archives and dive deep into them. So while the website gives you the short, tweetable version of scientific research, our goal here is to give you the full story. Let's meet our hosts for this week.
Hi, I'm Thanasi. I'm a PhD student at MIT, and I'm studying how we can move underwater robots around more efficiently.
Hi, I'm Devi. I'm also a PhD student at MIT, and I'm studying medical engineering.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jamie Devine. I am a postdoc at Beth Israel Deaconess in Boston, and I'm studying how sleep and pain are related.
So, Thanasi, let's jump right into your story.
Yeah, so I picked a fun article this week about physics students and how they learn. And one of the reasons why I really like this article is because it really ties into a lot of ideas that have come up recently in the educational research literature. I guess just to start off, the title of the paper is that Students' Preconceptions in Introductory Mechanics. And it's a paper by John Clement, who was at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And this paper is from 1980, so a bit of an oldie, but definitely a good one. John Clement is a physics professor at UMass and noticed that a lot of students were having similar issues in introductory mechanics classes, namely that they were making very similar mistakes on exams and problem sets dealing with forces and velocities and accelerations. And so he took this observation and started to run actual experiments and try to understand exactly what it was that the students were thinking, and was able to characterize that and pinpoint that preconceived notions that students came into the class with were what ultimately led them to kind of go astray in their understanding of ideas like what is a force and how does that manifest itself in the real world. And so while that concept might be really clear to a professor who's been dealing with physics for his or her entire professional career, it's not necessarily the clearest, and sometimes it's actually kind of very different from ideas that students have coming in. So this paper served as like a really nice early research paper indicating that we need to think more about how to actively engage students' preconceived notions and their misconceptions when we teach them new complex ideas.
So these aren't necessarily misconceptions like somebody going into a class on biology might have a lot of misconceptions about the details of evolution or the age of the earth or things like that.
Right.
Misinformation about theory of evolution, as opposed to somebody just hasn't quite thought about how exactly gravity works or how exactly motion works.
Right. And actually one of the interesting things that he brings up is he tries to touch on why do these students come in with these very specific wrong ideas about how forces act on bodies? Because what he noticed when he ran experiments and he just checked statistics on tests of how many students were getting certain kinds of questions wrong. So one of the questions that he asked was, if you have a pendulum just swinging, what draw out the forces that are acting on the pendulum at different times? And what he found was that most of the wrong answers looked very similar, with the main problem being that students usually thought that there was a force in the direction that the pendulum was moving, when in reality, that's not always the case. And so in order to try to understand where these common misconceptions come from, he suggests that a lot of this comes from experience, right? If you put something on the table and you try to push it, it's only going to move as long as you keep applying a force with your hand. And so there are a lot of sort of mini experiments or just real life experiences that we learn from as we're growing up that don't actually give us quite the right understanding of what's going on when we don't sit and really work to break them down formally.
I think it was interesting that the professor himself went over the mistakes that people made in the exams, because a lot of the times the professors in these large introductory physics classes aren't the ones who are grading the exams and might not even really look at them. It's just like the TAs who are grading the exams, and then they kind of get feedback about how many people, or just like what the general distribution of the scores were, and not necessarily looking at any individual student responses. So I feel like there might be kind of a disconnect that leads people to continue having the same misconceptions and not have them corrected because the people who are teaching aren't necessarily getting feedback from the students about what they're not understanding.
Absolutely. That's that's one of the important takeaways from this and a lot of research that has followed this paper in the last 20, 30 years, is that as an educator, as a teacher, you need to really be aware not only of what you're trying to teach your students, but what their preconceptions are about it, so that you can explicitly address misconceptions. Otherwise, they'll often find some way to sort of mash what you're telling them into this preconceived notion and just make it work well enough to get by the class.
So have they made any changes to how physics is taught because of this kind of research?
I think that that's a really good question. I think that a lot of, at least introductory mechanics classes, rely more heavily nowadays on drawing out force diagrams and on a lot of demos. And it definitely does come down to individual professors still, because I mean it's really them that have to address it. I don't know of a big broad movement in the physics community that says, every physics class is now taught, specifically addressing these misconceptions. But I would say that as a whole, the physics departments and the physics community in higher ed has been very aware of pedagogy and how it's teaching. And this is, you can see this from a lot of the papers that have been published in education journals, many of them, especially a little bit earlier before education research was more of its own field, a lot of that research was being done in physics departments. So they've definitely been aware of how they're teaching and what they can do to improve their teaching.
Do they have any other examples of misconceptions?
Yeah. So the most common one is this one that motion implies that there's a force in that direction. Some other ones have to do with centrifugal force. So that's something that a lot of people think is true. If you spin something around, whether it's in a centrifuge, which is a piece of scientific equipment that some people might be familiar with, or if you're let's say in a car going around a bend in the road, going around a circular track, you would feel like something's trying to push you out outwards, and you might think that there's a force acting away from you, kind of outwards from the center of the circle. But that's actually not a real force that's acting. That has to do with the fact that you're accelerating the car around the circle constantly. So that's another one from classical mechanics, I'd say.
So those are both in the same category of confusing momentum for a force, basically.
Yeah.
So like going back to the pendulum, when the pendulum's on the upswing, people mm-hmm. might think that there's a force moving it up, but it's just the momentum, and the only force that's acting on it is the force of gravity trying to push it the other direction, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the tension of the string that's holding it. Right. If it's a pendulum, it's on a string or a rod. So that also has a force. But I think that things get a lot trickier once you start doing rotational motion. So torques, torque in general can be really misleading in physics and just confusing for a lot of people, because we don't have a lot of experience growing up with it. And you never think, oh, hey, I'm applying this torque to open this jar. Let me think about where all the forces are acting, right? You just open a jar, open a Coke bottle, and go on your day.
I used to throw discus in high school, and our coach was always talking about torque.
Yeah?
Yeah, just constantly. And he never explained what it was. He was just like, you need torque if you're going to throw this far enough.
Oh, man, too bad he wasn't a physics teacher. Then maybe he could have... could have sat you down, given a good lesson on it.
Yeah, too bad. He definitely was not a physics teacher.
I feel like some of the misconception, at least for me in like high school physics classes, came from the fact that a lot of words in physics that have precise definitions are also words that are commonly used, like work and energy. Mm-hmm. So that you, when in physics class you're talking about doing work, that is a very different idea from what you might intuitively think about what doing work means, just from the way that you use the word work or the way you use the word energy in like a common non-physics setting.
So yeah, one of the really interesting things that Clement picked up on in this paper was that a lot of the misconceptions that his students were having in these mechanics classes were the same sorts of misconceptions that Galileo was starting to realize were a problem in Aristotle's picture of mechanics and how physics works. And so, you know, students today are still struggling with these preconceived notions that were the definition of physics for, you know, thousand years in human history. And it wasn't really until Newton came around and said definitively F equals MA that we got to this correct modern picture of how forces act on bodies and then how bodies respond to those forces. And that's interesting to me because it, you know, with things that seem to always have been as pervasive in society as motion and having to apply forces to things, it took a long time for us to understand how they actually work. And even then, you know, as we grow up experiencing these things now, we still struggle to get it when it's formally taught to us. So it has interesting implications to, you know, say with a lot of more complex things that we're dealing with now that we can't see, like quantum mechanics. You know, how do we teach it effectively? You know, how do we build people's intuition around it and make sure that they understand it, that they understand that it's not fitting within this worldview of what they experience every day?
So here's my favorite counterintuitive physics puzzle that I find people tend to have a hard time with. Suppose you're sitting in a car at a standstill, and you've got a balloon filled with helium floating there next to you, or I guess floating against the ceiling next to you. If you step on the gas, relative to your position in the car, sitting in the driver's seat, would the balloon stay in the same spot relative to you as you accelerate? Would it move forward or would it move backwards?
Now, this was actually like a problem in my recent fluid mechanics problem set.
Right. Yeah, and that's the key, is to think of it in terms of fluid mechanics.
Do you want us to give you our actual ideas?
Sure. Yeah, let's hear it.
I have no physics background. Minimal physics background. I don't know, like, would the balloon go backwards? That's what I would think is the most logical solution.
Yeah, like if it was, let's say it was like your coffee cup sitting on your roof and you accelerated, you would expect the coffee cup to not accelerate as fast as the car, right? To go flying off the roof.
Right.
Anybody else want to suggest an answer?
I'd say that it would go forward, if anything else, because if it's helium, it's going to be lighter than the air. And so the air would be much more inclined to be that heavy thing that wants to move to the back of the car.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you have to think of the air like a liquid, right? That you accelerate, the air wants to move backwards, which is going to, I don't know if there was the right word, but push the lighter than air helium forward.
Yep.
It's like, imagine if you had a bucket full of water and you jerk it to the left, all that water would shift over to the right side of the bucket. Like the heavier air is shifting to the back of the car and the lighter helium is shifting to the front of the car. So the balloon's actually accelerating faster than the car is. It's moving forward relative to your perspective as sitting in the driver's seat.
Mm-hmm. And that's because you get a lot of pressure from the air pushing it.
Yeah. Which is super counterintuitive.
Yep.
I definitely got it wrong the first time I heard it.
Yeah, I cheated. I study fluids for a living.
Not really cheating.
That's fair.
One of my favorite little tidbits of information, and if there was a paper on this, is that skateboarders actually have a better concept of physics than kids who don't skateboarder, you know, people who don't skateboard, because they're constantly doing physics problems in order to not break their heads open. So I wonder if, you know, if you had some skateboarder punks in these physics classes, would they be better at understanding these issues because, you know, they've probably accelerated with balloons in their car or that kind of stuff? Or would they make more issues, or would they have more problems with it because they've got more experience with what we think of as everyday physics?
I thought you were going to say more head injuries.
Huh, maybe that'll be an upcoming useful science paper. If you want your kid to be a physicist, encourage them to skateboard.
Right.
One thing to remember is that education, especially higher ed, has been evolving a lot in the last like 30 years. So while it seems it's starting to feel rather obvious that we should be addressing students' misconceptions as we're teaching them, and that teaching is a very active process, that's a fairly recent idea that's only been elaborated on since the 80s. And I'd say that this paper by John Clement is one of the earliest papers to really tackle it academically and scientifically. Before then, and still in certain departments and programs, teaching is treated as though you're just transferring knowledge, that there's some body of knowledge in your head and you need to give it to everybody else. And you just do that through dry lectures and they pick it up. And if they're not good enough, they don't pick it up well. And I think that in that framework, there's no reason to even be trying really hard to understand what all of your students' misconceptions are. But that's very much recognized nowadays as the wrong way to be teaching. So I think aside from any usefulness to the physics community that this paper has, in terms of the larger community of educators, it says a lot to the fact that we really need to be focusing on active learning and making sure that the students are engaged in the material and that that we're addressing their misconceptions as much as we're trying to focus on the novel content.
Boy, it's a lot more work to be a good teacher.
Oh, it's a tremendous amount of work.
Yeah. So we want to try out a new segment on the podcast called Ask Useful Science. And the concept is to have our listeners send us questions, and we will have the Useful Science team try to find science-backed answers for those questions. So maybe these are more practical questions about health or about the universe, or maybe there's more advice questions about, you know, what should I do in this situation, or how do people react in this particular situation? Well, you know, we're not quite sure what it's going to be, and that's why we're counting on you, the listener, to come up with some good questions that we can actually dig into the research and find answers for. We've got this really incredible and really enormous team behind Useful Science. If you go to usefulscience.org/about, you can see all their photos and profiles. It's this amazing brain trust that we have, and we want to try to put it to work for our listeners. So please tweet at us at Useful Sci on Twitter, or you can email us podcast@usefulscience.org your questions, and we will try to feature those on a future episode. So, Zvi, let's talk about your study about math anxiety and pain.
Sure. So, this is a paper published in PLOS One titled "When Math Hurts: Math Anxiety Predicts Pain Network Activation in Anticipation of Doing Math." And the goal of the study was to see if there was a neural mechanism that they could identify behind why some people who have a lot of math anxiety might choose to avoid doing math. And the main way that they gauged this was by looking at fMRI data. And fMRI is a type of MRI that's called like functional MRI, where they use MRIs in a way such that you can track where blood is flowing in the brain and what parts of the brain are using up more blood. And that's kind of used as a proxy for activity of those brain areas, because areas of the brain that are using more blood and need more blood flow are probably more active. And so what they did is they took people and they asked them a series of questions, like a standard panel of questions that are used to gauge a person's level of math anxiety. So they asked them questions like, how do you feel when you are given a math textbook or when you have to do a certain type of math problem, and kind of give them a score and classify them as people who had high math anxiety and people who had low math anxiety. And then what they did is they put them in this fMRI scanner and they gave them a mixture of two types of problems. One of them were math-related problems, so they would give them like an equation and they'd ask them whether a solution to the equation was correct or not. And they also gave them more kind of like word cognition problems. So they gave them a series of letters and asked them if that series of letters backwards was an English word or not. And so they kind of tried to separate this out between kind of math ability type questions and non-math ability type questions. And so they had them do that, like a series of those questions, randomly kind of intermixed while they're in this fMRI scanner, while they're looking at their brains. But between each question, they would give them a cue that was telling them, is the next question that's coming up a math question, or is the next question that's coming up a word question? So they could track what is going on in people's brains when they're anticipating that they're about to do a math question versus that they're about to do a word type question. And what they found was, first of all, kind of as you would predict, the people who had higher math anxiety tended to do worse on the math questions. They took longer to respond, and they didn't get as many of them right. But what they also found was that in certain areas of the brain that kind of before had been linked with perception of pain, that those areas were more active in people who reported high math anxiety when they were anticipating doing the math. So when they were given that cue right beforehand that was told them, hey, you're about to do another math problem, than people who had less math anxiety. And that effect wasn't determined by kind of their general level of anxiety. So it's not like they were just more anxious people in general. It wasn't predicted by their level of ability at the word problems. And also, I think surprisingly, is that it wasn't accounted for entirely by the performance. So people's anxiety about doing math was linked to how well they did, but even controlling for that, you still saw an effect where how anxious you feel report about being about math activates these kind of like pain networks, or in those people, their pain networks are more activated when they're anticipating, even regardless of their level of ability. So kind of even if you control for that, the effect is still there, which is interesting. So it's not just that people are linking this to, you know, the fact that they're about to do bad in a math problem, but it's more kind of the fact that they feel like they're about to do bad in a math problem. Yeah, I'm kind of relying on Jamie to give all the analysis on this or the methodological studies or limitations. Since I don't actually know that much about fMRI, so I feel like I can't really comment on whether the way they did the fMRI was good or not.
Well, you gave a good description of what fMRI is, so you're already ahead of the curve.
I just remember doing like reading a lot about fMRI in the past, and every kind of summary that I've read of it has been, this is what it's about, but the details are very complicated, and a lot of people do fMRI studies that aren't really well designed, and then the results aren't very well interpretable. So every time I see an fMRI study, I'm like, that's interesting, but I don't know whether this is legit or not, and I am not qualified to make the determination, but it seems cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, personally, one of my issues with it is that it tracks brain blood flow. So they sort of say it's a proxy for activity, but it really is just where in your brain is blood going. So not sure how that really translates to electrical activity or what kind of brain patterns there are. You know, it might be taking someone with anxiety more energy or, but I haven't done fMRI in the pain field for 8 years or so now. And so I don't want to say that there's one way that's right or wrong or whatever. One of the issues, whenever you're trying to track something in a human brain, is it's just always going to have some gaps, because you can't just dissect these brains. You can't cut someone open and poke at them. So there's issues with any kind of way you want to track what's happening in the human brain. And fMRI is no different from EEG or, you know, any other method you want to use.
This idea of math anxiety is a little surprising to me. I wonder if that has to do with, if you could relate that to performance anxiety, like a musician might have or an athlete might have, or if it's more just a fear of looking dumb, right? Like if somebody were to start quizzing me on state capitals, I might get pretty anxious because I'm not very good at that. But I would not at all compare that to the kind of anxious feeling I get if I'm going to perform music live. I wonder what that experience is actually like for people that feel like they have a lot of anxiety over math.
I hate doing math. And I would say I probably am very math anxious. The feeling I get when I know a math problem is coming is just very similar to if someone asks you to run up a ridiculously steep hill. You can do it. You're not going to do it well, and you just don't want to do it. So it's not so much about feeling stupid. It's just I would rather not have to put any effort into this. It just seems like such a monumental task.
It's just not pleasant.
Yeah.
But I think one of the other things that they found in this study that kind of is different from the analogy that you just gave is that they found that people didn't have extra activity or blood flow in those areas of the brain when they're actually doing the problem. So while they're doing the problem, those areas weren't particularly actively involved. But when they were anticipating it, they were. And they kind of talked about maybe how that was just because when you're actually doing the problem, you're kind of distracted by the fact that you're doing this cognitive process. And so you're not, you know, you're not devoting as much attention to the fear as you are to like actually trying to figure out this problem. And so that while you're actually doing it, you're okay, relatively. But it's really the anticipation that's more painful, which I guess is kind of, I think most people would agree that a lot of the times anticipation of something bad is worse than actually doing it. And you just kind of need to rip the Band-Aid off.
Did they have any controls for this? Like they tell people, you know, in this next one, you're going to get a slight shock or physical pain? Or did they see this with any kind of different paradigm?
You mean, did they have any like actual painful stimulus and then see whether it was in that or other types of anticipatory?
Well, that would be one option. Or did they see this with people who have high word problem anxiety? Or did they have any kind of control to see if this was related to math specifically, or if this was related to anxiety and doing a type of activity?
Oh, so they did also have like a cue that told you you're about to do a word problem, and they compared it to that. And I think there wasn't an effect between the people who had high math anxiety and any level of like fear induction when they're told they're about to do a word problem.
Did they figure out if people have high word problem anxiety?
Yeah, I don't think so.
So,
which would be an interesting.
I mean, the big question I have is this a math thing or is this an anxiety thing? You know, if I'm anxious about singing, am I going to have more pain before I have to sing in an MRI than someone who doesn't care about singing?
Sure. And I think the point maybe isn't necessarily that this is a phenomenon that is specific to math and that might only happen in math. I think one of the motivations they had for studying math is that it was a area where people are known to kind of have fear, but that it wasn't necessarily, there was no evolutionary impetus for people to experience fear about math, whereas there is for having fear about being physically harmed. And so kind of looking at what might the neural mechanisms be for this type of fear that isn't really evolutionarily driven in a certain way. So I think that the authors might expect that if they did a similar thing for word anxiety, which I don't know if that's necessarily something that people study as much, that they might see a similar effect. Though I feel like I have not necessarily word anxiety. I feel like I get writing-related anxiety. Like if I have to write like a fellowship proposal, I just get like really worked up about it and then put it off a lot. So in that sense, I feel like I can, although I'm not a particularly math anxious person, I was a math major in undergrad. I feel like I can empathize with that kind of feeling in some ways. And it's not because I feel like, again, it's not like I feel like I'm necessarily bad at it, but just like I don't want to do this. But then like when I am writing, it just kind of goes and I'm fine. But just like getting over that initial hump, I guess.
I think this would be really interesting if they looked at more common fears or more common anxieties. So public speaking, and I can't really think any off the top of my head that you can really replicate in an fMRI.
Right.
Yeah, that's a thing.
I mean, they could have just added a couple more tasks and given us a much more robust photograph of if this is pain related to anxiety in general, or if this is something that might be specific to cognitive processes.
I think they also had like a little questionnaire before where they asked people just about their general, like non-specific anxiety. So just like, are you an anxious person in general? I don't know if that's also what you're getting at, but
Well, yeah, but then if they, you know, if they asked, like, what are you anxious about, and then made them do that in the fMRI as opposed to just giving them math, I'd like to see if it's the same pathway, or, I mean, math in the brain is a different thing than public speaking in the brain.
Sure.
So what pathways are getting activated?
So what are these fMRI scanners like? Are they like just a normal MRI machine, just like one of those big, big tubes you just kind of have to sit still in, or are they like a smaller thing just around the head?
No, it's the same magnet. So okay. The difference between an MRI and an fMRI is just sort of the program they run.
Mm-hmm.
So the table shakes, and you're stuck in a small tube. So there's all sorts of things that can activate your anxiety. It's claustrophobic. You're alone in a room, the screening to go in, you know, they ask you, do you have any metal in your body? Have you ever gotten any shrapnel in your eyes that could be pulled out by the magnet? So it's...
And on top of all that, they're asking you to do math.
Right, yeah. Well, when I did fMRI research, we would physically hurt the people while they were in the magnet. So we were even worse. And oftentimes it was, you know, we would... had a cage we put on their face with heat probes and like a Velcro brush that we would scratch their face with.
Wow.
So they're stuck in a magnet and then we're doing this to their face. So certainly doing math isn't the worst thing you could do in a magnet. But it really looks like what you would see on a medical TV show or in a movie.
Yeah. I just wonder, I mean, I guess in this case, you're not really doing any lasting harm to people, but like ethics-wise, getting IRB approval, is it hard to get approval for studies where you're causing people pain on purpose and looking at their brains?
I don't know, because I've never really tried to get IRB approval for a study that didn't look at pain.
Sure.
So I don't know how much easier it was for other people. The one problem is we would use healthy subjects, but then we would also use people with chronic pain. And it was much harder to get something approved for chronic pain or recovering drug addicts, like people who used opioids. That was very difficult to get through the IRB, mostly because of the payment issue. How are we going to pay these people in a way that wasn't going to, encourage them to go spend that money on drugs. But human research in general is just a pain. literally a pain to do human research because, you know, you can keep rats in a cage. You can keep flies in a tube. Humans, they just do whatever they want.
So, Jamie, broadly speaking, is there evidence that the brain reacts to mental pain similarly to how it reacts to physical pain?
I don't know that. Yeah, so that isn't something I've ever looked at. And I just don't know off the top of my head, but that's certainly an interesting question and one that, you know, if we had more time, like in a future episode, maybe I'll go into that and do some research in the interim.
Or if a listener is an expert on this and wants to let us know, we can follow up on this. Talking about math anxiety, you know, there are people in the world that do Sudoku to relax.
No.
Maybe calling Sudoku math is a little generous, but it's interesting that what is terrifying for one person is kind of relaxing for another person.
If it's got numbers in it, I don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah. I enjoy estimating percentages in my head for some reason. Like if I'm grading papers and it's like, oh, so they got a 35 out of 42. About what percent is that?
I like math, but I hate doing that. Like, I'm not particularly good at like mental arithmetic. And that's something that does make me a little like, if I'm ever like stuck trying to like calculate the bill or something, like trying to do everyone's tip or something, that's something I'm just like, oh, I really don't want to do this. But again, major to math.
Yeah,
I am terrible at math. I am once had an EEG show what was happening in my brain when I was doing a math problem. And the whole screen just went blank. There was no math. But I love doing statistics.
Wait, so what is an EEG measure exactly?
It was not for a research project. It was part of an art installation.
Huh.
Electrodes on your head and showed your brain waves on a big screen. And I guess biofeedback is sort of the theme of that art piece. But I hate math. I can't do math. I'm very bad at it. My brain agrees. But I love doing statistics.
Huh.
Interesting.
So that's something that seems like a little bit contradictory to me, because I feel like whenever I do, like when I'm starting to do statistics, especially for anything scientific, it seems very math intensive, especially if I'm trying to figure out exactly what kind of test I need to use, or like the more subtle like theory behind the statistics, it quickly becomes just like applied measure theory and a lot of math. And that's why I feel like when I hear people say that we need to, like, for example, in medical education, a lot of people say that we need to kind of de-emphasize calculus for pre-meds and have more statistical stuff. That seems like a good idea to a point for me, but I feel like once you get to sufficiently advanced statistics, which a lot of research will require, and a lot of kind of understanding research papers requires, it requires you to understand calculus and even more advanced math, so I feel like it's kind of a trade-off. So I guess, in your experience, what about kind of math you find kind of challenging or anxiety-inducing, but that isn't there in statistics?
Well, in statistics, you're looking in this whole data set, and all of these numbers are representative of, you know, a measure. So after a while, you stop seeing the numbers, you stop seeing the math, you start seeing, okay, this is their blood pressure, this is the person's name, you know, their subject number. And especially when you're using statistical software like SPSS or R or even Excel, it does the physical math for you. It does the adding and the subtracting and all of the terrible, terrible things.
like multiplication.
So really, multiplication. So you can really concentrate on what am I trying to see? So you can sort of turn it into a word problem in your head, or turn it into sort of a map or a story. And it's not just 1 + 1 = 7 or whatever.
whatever happens to be. Oh boy, Jamie, you really are bad at math.
And I still got my PhD. So if anyone out there is listening and thinking you can't get a PhD and be bad at math, you can. Right here, living proof.
Anybody go see Star Wars this week?
I saw it yesterday.
Oh yeah, how was it? Without any spoilers.
It was very good. It was comparable to the originals, as opposed to being comparable to the ones in the late 90s, early 2000s, which I thought it was going to be.
I think the important thing is that it absolutely feels like a Star Wars movie. Like, it really, really does feel like Star Wars to me.
And one thing they really did to help that is they did a lot more live stuff than CGI. There was not nearly as much CGI as you could have had.
Yeah. And it's really funny. I'd say it's the funniest of any of them. And the new characters that they introduce are fantastic. Really, really fantastic.
No Jar Jars.
No Jar Jars. The same character. I like Jar Jar.
Yeah, it's not like they said, okay, we need a new Han Solo. We need a new Luke. We need a new Leia. They're totally unique.
Are the same actors?
Oh yeah, they're in there too, but I mean, like, they weren't trying to recreate a new generation of the same types of
Oh, we need another bounty hunter. Oh, we need
exactly, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm waiting to go home for break and get to see it with my brother.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering. Okay, so you guys like doing math. Okay, figure out at what point are we allowed to talk about the plot of the movie?
Yeah, what's the statute of limitations on spoilers?
Yeah, how many weeks does it need to be in theater before I'm allowed to talk about Jar Jar Binks being, you know, the big bad guy at the end? I mean...
I listen to this other podcast where they talk about, like, pop culture and movies and stuff a lot. And sometimes apparently they get complaints when they spoil, like, Citizen Kane, which is, like, a 90-year-old movie.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
I think you're allowed to spoil...
Yeah.
Really, really old movies.
Especially when it's become a joke, right? I mean, Rosebud, that's a joke. Or Luke, I am your father, that's a joke.
If you get to the point where you've heard Luke, I am your father, and you haven't seen Star Wars, then you deserve it. Also, apparently, there's been research or something that shows that people who have movies spoiled for them don't actually enjoy it any less.
Yeah, I remember that.
There's a good useful science fact. Justifies all of our movie spoiling in our podcast.
Oh, man. Yeah, that would be, if that was tweeted, that would be one way I would not check to see what the at replies were.
So, Jamie, let's talk about your study about personality traits and their effect on our health.
Okay, so the useful science little blurb about this is personality traits are associated with expression levels of genes that regulate inflammation and therefore may be biologically linked to how well people fight disease. It's a very nice blurb, but it's not specific enough to let you know what actually happened in the paper. So I feel like a lot of people who read that blurb might come away with some incorrect assumptions. The actual paper is Personality and Gene Expression. Do individual differences exist in the leukocyte transcriptome? So the lead author is Kavita Vidhara. And this was published in Psychoneuroendocrinology in February 2015. So what they actually found is that two traits that are linked to the big five of personality are related to differences in gene expression. So before I go on, let me describe what we mean by personality and what we mean by the big five. So personality is a stable cluster of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that sort of make up who this person is. And these five big traits are often called five-factor model, the big five, or sometimes they're just shortened to OCEAN or CANOE, which is an acronym for what they are. So if we're going with OCEAN, it's openness to experience, conscientiousness, which is how cautious someone is, extroversion, how friendly that person is, agreeableness, and neuroticism, which could be thought of how anxious they are, how fearful, how negative they are as a person.
Like Woody Allen.
So, yes. Definitely, Woody Allen would be a very high on the neuroticism scale.
It is so, blowing my mind right now that OCEAN and CANOE are anagrams. I had never noticed that before.
Yeah, that got me too. So this was a psychological theory that got started in the 60s, forgotten, picked up again in the 80s, and is still going on today. And so personality, it's thought that your personality is not only inherited, but also because of your environment. So who you are is nature and nurture. But this applies to these five big personality factors. So the theory underlying why they did this study is that immunity is associated with your personality, and it's a behavioral immune response. So someone with a weak immune system will learn to react to situations differently than someone with a stronger immune system. So if you aren't good at fighting off the common cold, you're probably not going to be as friendly as someone who's nearly impervious to bacteria or viruses. So this paper specifically looked at the mechanisms. They weren't looking at if these personality traits are related to better health, they were looking at specifically what mechanism of health. So one problem I did have with the paper is that the background, which does look at how personality and health are related, is a little less consistent than the paper that I'm reviewing right now makes it sound, a little less consistent than I would be comfortable with as a topic. So in some of these, it was neuroticism and conscientiousness were associated with either dying earlier or later. But a lot of the papers even cited in this psychoneuroendocrinology paper were that there were no association between personality and if someone got cancer.
So they're kind of mischaracterizing the thing they were citing.
It seems like that to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I went online and tried to find papers associated to this behavioral immune response theory. And it wasn't enough to convince me that it's the most exciting theory I've seen. But I'm sure someone with a much deeper background has better arguments either for or against it. So what they did is they had 121 people. They measured their personality using the NEO five-factor inventory. So NEO is neuroticism, extroversion, openness to experience, five-factor inventory. They asked them questions about their behavior, their health behaviors, but then they took a blood sample and tested it for gene expression of pro-inflammatory genes. So they tested for 19 pro-inflammatory genes and 34 type 1 interferon responses, which is signals and like proteins that signal and regulate the immune system and antibodies. So they didn't test how these people respond to an infection. They just sort of tested on any given day how active is their immune system, which is another caveat by my calculations. So what they found is that leukocyte gene expression, so white blood cell gene expression, was related to extroversion and conscientiousness. So people who were more extroverted, more friendly, had higher gene expression of pro-inflammatory genes. So they were more on higher alert. And people who were more conscientious, so cautious, maybe a little anxious, they did not have as robust pro-inflammatory gene expression. They didn't find any other associations. So it, like, the big one that people were wondering about is neuroticism. Is neuroticism related to your ability to respond to an infection? And while they didn't find that neuroticism was related to anything in the gene expression category, they did find that people who were more extroverted or more conscientious were less neurotic. So their idea there is that perhaps neuroticism, which has been picked up in with regards to health in other studies, might be more of a proxy. Conscientiousness and extroversion are more directly related to gene expression.
So some of these traits are themselves correlated to each other?
Yes.
It seems like not maybe the best metric to use then.
No, and I was excited to read this paper at first, and then when I got through it, I really was underwhelmed. So I think, first of all, the big five link to health in the first place isn't a very strong field. So there's not as much information as I would like for it to be considered, you know, like a serious, obvious biological link.
And have there been a lot of other papers that you're aware of in this field trying to definitively link health? I mean, because it seems like this one is sort of...
This one is one of the first, I think, that was looking at the mechanism of health. Okay. So what's interesting there is that they were looking, you know, here's your personality and this is your blood. So what are we seeing? There have been a number... I looked at, you know, trying to get an idea for the field, I looked at who else has done this, and a lot of them were, what's the personality, and then what is their health like from a questionnaire perspective, or from a cancer diagnosis perspective, or from a mortality perspective. Okay. So this one was the first one that was really, or this was the first one that I've seen that looked at how this is related to your bodily expression of immunity as opposed to sort of the real world expression of your health.
Okay. It's like, this is how your body is ready to fight off infection. You know, with these are kind of the strong tools in your, or the strength of the tools in your tool chest. And how does that compare to your, to these different personality traits?
Yes. So, I mean, I think that is really interesting that they did find that people who were more friendly had more gene expression. But what I would have really liked to see is them activating the immune system and seeing how these personality factors were really related to response to a potential infection, as opposed to just on any given day, you know, how many troops do you have rolling around your body?
Hmm. Jamie, is this research somewhat built on the idea that our personalities are to a certain extent genetic and immutable?
Yes.
Does that seem right?
That's the major a major aspect of personality theory and the Big Five, is that part, like, your personality is partially inherited and partially environmental. So same as your gene expression is partially inherited and partially environmental, and same as, you know, your skin color or anything you really, anything biological related to you, is a mixture of what you've inherited from your parents and the environment that you're growing up on.
So there's some nature and there's some nurture in all of these different things that, right, that express themselves to make us who we are.
Right. And that personality is no different.
I just looked up the heritability of the Big Five personality traits. And apparently, to some twin studies, it's between 40 and 60%.
Wow. Not a very comforting thought.
No. I mean, I think with this kind of stuff, it's a little frustrating because the variability is so great, and because it's not always something, you know, you can measure someone's personality and maybe that day they were really anxious or something. Maybe they would have a different personality rating on another day. So a lot of times in psychology, people find what they're looking for.
Yeah.
While it's, you know, a lot of this data is coming to say that, you know, we're very much predisposed to one kind of, genetically predisposed to some personality traits or some sort of behaviors. The intensity of the nature is also very much different for different people as the nurture is different for different people as they're growing up. And so, you know, I don't think we should think about it on a black and white scale, saying, you know, oh, well, you have this expression and you're predisposed to this, because it's more of a, that your genes might push you in one direction, but you can still, there might be steps you can take to, once you're aware of that, to try to counteract it if it's not something that is desirable for you.
I think in particular with gene expression of your white blood cells, I mean, that's something that I would assume would vary day to day or hour by hour. I mean, like, so neutrophils, which are, I mean, white blood cells, live for like a day or something, order of magnitude. And so there's a lot of turnover of those. And so your level of gene expression very well could just be a function of whether you're sick or whether your body's fighting off infection. And I would definitely assume that they are, less so than, you know, your past history of, you know, how many germs you were brought up around or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. And that's one of the major shortcomings of this paper, is that I think they should have done something to stimulate the immune system and mm-hmm. see what the actual response is, as opposed to just how many genes are floating around.
What would you say is, like, the, you know, we talked a lot about kind of the bigger picture of what this paper means, but what would you say is kind of, what does it boil down to in terms of a useful, actionable item? Is there anything that you would take away from this?
I mean, I would say the first takeaway that I would give people is that this paper and sort of our own summary on useful science gives a little more credit than the results do. So the theory seems to be much more grandiose than the than the data supporting the theory of behavioral immune response. But at the end of it, don't ignore your feelings. If you're feeling like you don't want to go out and don't want to see people, that's called sickness behavior, you know? So don't ignore the way you're feeling, because it's important for your health, not just your psychological health, but your ability to fight off infections and everything like that. Listen to your body and don't just be an idiot about it.
Search your feelings, Luke.
Spoilers.
Sorry for that.
Search your feelings, Luke. You know, if you take the bus, you will get sick.
Well, that's our show. Thank you for listening. As always, you can find the show notes at our website. That would be at usefulscience.org/podcast/8. That's the number 8, since that's the episode number here. From there, you can also link through to each of the articles that we've talked about. And we also would love to get some feedback from you. You can tweet at us at usefulsci, or you can email me at podcast@usefulscience.org. I want to thank our host for this episode, Dr. Jamie K. Devine, who you can follow on Twitter at JK_Devine, David De Silva, who you can follow at David De Silva, all crammed together into one word, and Thanasi, Athanasios Athanasiadis. Did I get that?
Spot on.
Oh, yeah. You're pretty good at it. Thanasi does not have a Twitter, but he has a website that you can check out, which is his nickname spelled backwards. Thanasi spelled backwards. ISANAHT.com. So thank you for listening, and I hope you have a very useful week. Snape kills Dumbledore.
You might make someone mad about that if they got mad about Citizen Kane.
Yeah, this is our tactic to get more listener feedback. It's just to spoil as many popular books and movies as possible.
No, I'm kidding. I won't put that in the show.
We don't have to put any of this in the show.